everybody. Welcome back to the Film Buds podcast. This is our 14th bonus show. And my name is Henry.
And I'm Paul.
And joining us once again, welcome back to the show, Henry Wilkinson.
Hello.
Hi.
Or Henry number two, as he's also
yeah,
many
Wilkie.
Other
things. Yeah. Yeah. Lots of different nicknames here.
Yeah. Well, man, it's great to see you.
It's good to see you too. Yeah.
And Paul, of course. I mean, it's always a pleasure. Paul?
Yeah. Always glad to be here. You know, always glad to talk with other people about film and yeah. that kind of thing. So it's good to be here.
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much for downloading. The donations go to help support the monthly upkeep of the show. So we always appreciate that a lot. And this time around, we are going to be talking Disney live action, more specifically, some of the remakes, reboots, reimaginings, you know, whatever you want to call it, from recent years. We've already talked about, Henry, you included, we've talked about a number of them over the years on the regular show, so make sure to check those out. And then Paul, you and I just reviewed the Mulan remake as well, so we've talked about a lot, and so now we're kind of filling in the gaps, so to speak. On the list is Alice Through the Looking Glass, Pete's Dragon, Nutcracker and the Four Realms, Beauty and the Beast, and Christopher Robin. Right.
Yeah.
And who knows what else will come up? You never know. So, yeah, it's nice to have you all here. It's great to be recording another episode.
Yeah.
You know, always fun. Well, guys, how you doing? I mean, you guys are just meeting for the first time. You should say that.
Yeah. Well, I've heard your voice. I listened to the Mulan episode, which is pretty great.
Oh, thanks.
So, like, I feel like I sort of know you already.
Yes.
Even though this is our first time together.
Yeah, it's, you know, I see that you've got quite a lot of Broadway back there, and...
oh, yes, definitely.
My wife went to musical theater, sort of conservatory in Virginia, so...
oh, cool.
I don't know quite as much as her, and certainly not you, but I have a little bit of a passing knowledge and certainly an appreciation, so...
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
Although we have already talked about Disney a lot, I guess, just in case for new listeners, we can give maybe a little background as to our, I guess, with these films specifically, but I guess Disney in general and what we feel about them. Guys, how are you feeling about Disney?
Maybe I should go second.
Oh, Paul?
Well, you know, Disney... you know, Disney is a massive entity at this point, and it certainly is part of, you know, the whole media conglomeration, you know, down to very select group of companies that have quite a lot of say and sway in what you're looking and what you're watching. And, you know, Disney owns so many brands now. I mean, that's been Bob Iger's MO as, you know, CEO and leader of Disney. Some of what
Supreme
they've been doing.
Supreme Overlord.
Yeah. Supreme Chancellor Iger.
Yeah.
So, you know, it certainly has been an interesting turn of events. And some of what they've been putting out lately has been great. And I've really enjoyed it. And some of it has been disappointing. So, you know,
yeah.
I'm hoping that something will shift sometime soon. You know, I think that at a certain point, taste change over time. That's what history always tells us. And right now it's just a real grab bag. It's one of those off generations of Disney, you know, those in between years.
Henry, I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm sure people have heard some of your episodes, but,
yeah,
I know you have a lot of Disney knowledge and background.
Oh, I sure do. I have
yes.
my Lumiere. I have my Sugar Plum Fairy.
Oh, nice.
Like,
nice.
I love Disney as like an objective sort of like the artistic side and the artists and the ideas and the creativity. I really admire like that side of things. The marketing conglomerate, you know, seeping into our everyday lives sort of bit is a little scary to me. And I think, you know, talking with Chloe, it's like, enjoy Disney, but I'm critical of them. Like, I don't completely drink the Kool-Aid, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I enjoy Disney very much. Like, I have so much of a stake in Disney at this point that I can't hate it. But I also, you know, I'm very critical of, you know, not everything they do is perfect. I definitely agree that, like, we're in a very between, you know, phase where a lot of the stuff that they're putting out is just sort of mediocre. I think, you know, they maybe need to focus a little bit more on the creative artistic side and a little less on, you know, making these billion-dollar blockbuster, you know, making as much money as possible, you know,
right.
I think go back to the creative roots. Yeah. So I guess that's my take, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm kind of predictably in the middle. Like, you know, I mean, there's some I really love, you know, I mean, I love the creative side as well, but I agree. It's kind of become, with them having kind of done the monopoly effect, and mm-hmm. it's just starting to feel a little too recycled, a little too interconnected yeah. with everything, you know, like an obligation. But that being said, there are still so many films, even recent films, that I enjoy in one way or the other, and then some I really don't. And so mm-hmm. I think I guess we're all on the same page in that respect. So
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, well, I mean, guys, you want to get into it?
Sure,
let's do it. Let's go.
All right, so all right, well, the first film we can talk about, going in order of release, is Alice Through the Looking Glass, which came out in 2016. And as a little background, so this one made $299.5 million against a $170 million budget. So not a huge hit commercially, considering the budget size. And we did talk about Alice in Wonderland, the Tim Burton film, on the regular show. But this is the sequel, prequel, kind of, I don't even know what you would call it, really. And, yeah.
All of the above.
Yeah. The synopsis is, Alice returns to the whimsical world of Wonderland and travels back in time to help the Mad Hatter. And this, it's directed by James Bobin, who did the Muppets films. And it stars Mia Wasikowska, Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter, Anne Hathaway, Sacha Baron Cohen, Rhys Ivins, Matt Lucas, Geraldine James, Timothy Spall, Alan Rickman, Richard Armitage, many others, I think, as well. It's pretty stacked. All right, well, this one, I mean, who wants to kick things off? What a great place to start.
Well, I don't know. Paul, do you want to go, or should I go?
Any takers?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah,
take it away.
I don't know. Well, okay. I took my brother and my next door neighbor to see this when it came out in 2016. And I remember, how did I spend money on this movie? Mm. And how did I end up here in the theater? How did this movie get onto the screen? Like, the sequence of events, I still wonder about it. And I haven't seen it since then. I watched it for this, you know, episode. And I still am so bewildered, like, completely. Like, I understand the first Alice in Wonderland movie did so well commercially, they had to do a sequel. It's, like, prerequisite. But, like, I just, you know, when doing a sequel, you need to ask yourself, is there a story that needs to be told? And I don't think they knew what they were trying to tell story-wise. And it feels more like an afternoon cartoon special, like that type of plot, you know, that can be condensed down into like 26 minutes. Yeah. It doesn't feel like a movie to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, objectively, I like a lot of different elements of the film, but the sum of their parts, I don't think is very great. Like, Colleen Atwood's costumes, always great. She's always phenomenal. Sacha Baron Cohen is great. Yeah. I really enjoyed him. I think Mia Wasikowska was better in this film than she was in the first Alice, because I think she's, you know, sort of expanded her acting chops between, I guess, 2009, 2010, when the first one came out in 2016.
Yeah.
You know, she did Jane Eyre and Crimson Peak and, you know, a whole bunch of, you know, very intense dramatic roles. So I think she's a better actress in this. But, like, the story, the writing, and Danny Elfman's music, it feels like a pastiche of Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
It's like, where's the creativity, Danny? Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I definitely feel like it's that corporate side of Disney. Like, we just have to put out a sequel, try to make some money off of it. Who cares about, you know, an actual piece of artwork as a film, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And so, it was executive produced by Tim Burton. So basically just a financial backing. So it didn't really have the same,
it didn't have his like creative input, you know, and it feels that way. You know, you could feel Tim Burton in the first film, and this one is missing some of that, you know, side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Paul, you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. So I was living in LA like sometime after this movie had come out, but around the time where like this movie was relevant, Pete's Dragon was coming out, BFG was coming out, Beauty and the Beast was coming out. And so living in LA at that time, you saw the marketing for these movies just absolutely fucking everywhere.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Choking on it. So like I went and I didn't watch the first Alice in Wonderland movie, which I guess is also the second Alice in Wonderland movie, but that's beside the point. But I went, I didn't go back and watch it. I was like, I'm just going to jump right in and we're going to see how this plays out.
Great.
And, you know, I was just like, oh yeah, I forgot about the whole boat thing. Like immediately I was just like, oh yeah, I forgot about the whole ship captain thing, you know? And I was like, right, okay, so here's where we left off. And then she immediately pulls off the Johnny Depp, you know, Jack Sparrow kind of, you know, bullshittery with the boat. And I was just like, that's what we're in for. Okay. Understood.
Yeah.
And then I went and I like looked up the movie after it was done, and I saw that it was, you know, directed by James Bobbin, and I was like, oh, you know, he's done some good stuff. Then he also did the Dora movie. And then
Oh, it's a classic.
Yeah. And then I looked at the writer, and it's Linda Wolverton.
Yes.
Who did Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, but then she also did the first Alice in Wonderland, Maleficent, Maleficent 2. Yeah, and suddenly I was like, oh, it makes sense now. All the pieces are aligning. And so, you know, it's, there are individual parts, that are fine with it. There's some cool design visual elements that, even though, you know, it's someone doing an evocation of Tim Burton, it still at least comes out looking okay. But no, it definitely has, it feels small. It has like that same problem that you get when you go back and you watch like the old Star Wars prequels, where you're suddenly like, oh, they're all just standing in a green screen room and they can only take like 5 steps to the left or right. And that's just it. They're like out of the stage, you know? And so, the movement, that's, I think, definitely why it feels a little weird, you know, is because this thing was done on a tiny little stage with a bunch of, you know, smart LEDs. So that way they could just do all the lighting right there without having it. It's one guy, you know, it's just a switchboard. And it feels that way, you know, it feels like a slapdash sequel where the first movie made $1 billion and they were like, we have to do a second. The people demand it. And
did they really?
And then honestly, it feels like it has like as much time travel as all three of the Back to the Future movies in like one film.
There's a whole lot.
So, you know, it's just a real all over the place kind of experience. But you know, I like parts of it. I'm not sure how I felt about, I guess, Reese Ifans' family, or like Reese Ifans and all the other like high tops being so stiff. That was one thing that really kind of bothered me, because Reese Ifans is such a great kind of kooky character kind of actor that it felt wasted to have him be, you know, sort of like stiff British. How did you feel, other Henry, original Henry, Henry the first?
Henry with the beanie.
Yes, there we go. Yes, Beanie Henry. Yeah. We're both original. All of us are original here. So Henry, I'm similar to you. So I saw this in the theaters, sadly. I enjoyed the first one a fair bit. I still do. And so I was looking forward to it, and I was intrigued by the just weird visuals. I love that kind of thing. But I've watched it. I think I've been trying to like it over the years, so I've probably watched it 3 times total, so, and once just recently. And every time I feel like it starts out okay. I think the Johnny Depp motivation and that very quick moment is all right. I feel like there's a little bit of heart there, but then once mm-hmm. the plot kicks in of what, you know, is there, it really falls apart. Like, it's so jumbled. And like Paul, you were saying, the time travel is out of control. And I think there are some scenes in terms of special effects that look incredible. It's so colorful. It's you know, so well designed. Mm-hmm. And then there are other times that do not look good. Like mm-hmm. even I remember at the time seeing it, like it did not look good. Like the ocean, like wave flying yeah. thing, like where Sacha Baron Cohen is doing his little arm number. Not great. Mm-hmm. Not great looking. No. And so, like, it's parts like that that really bog it down. But really, the biggest issue by far is there's so little story, you know. And Paul, like you were saying, there are, you know, a couple moments here and there that I enjoy and I want to like it more than I do. But gosh, by the third act, you're like, geez, let's, yeah, where are we going? Yeah. Let's wrap it
up. Like, with so little story, how can it feel so convoluted and like, yeah. you know?
Yeah. I'm not a fan of it either as much as I would like to be.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess the one thing that I'll give it is I did like how the sort of rules of their time travel were sort of instantaneous. Like, they locked eyes mm-hmm. and there was no like second chances. Like, that was it, you know? Mm-hmm. Yep. So I'll give it that. And that was a nice moment. I was like, oh good. It wasn't like you know, one person starts to fade. It was like, oh no, this is like, you know, this is actually terrible. But then, yeah. you know, it actually, yeah. it has, you know, it has that little moment where it's like, we wrote ourselves into a corner. They're all frozen. Somehow mm-hmm. it still connects, you know?
yeah.
so,
like,
you
what
know.
Are the odds?
Yeah. How about that? Aren't yeah. they lucky? It's magnetic.
yeah.
so, but I did like a lot of the returning voice cast. You know, that's the one thing that I will give this movie is that, like, it casts very, very well. You know, yeah, the first one yeah. had a great cast. The second one has a great cast. And everyone does a great...
Hearing Alan... you go.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, just hearing Alan Rickman's voice, you know, I yeah. think this is the first time in a long time that I've heard his voice, and it, like, it made me really emotional at first yeah. when, like, the butterfly started speaking. I'm like, I miss you. Yeah. I wish you were here. Yeah.
Yeah, every you know, speaking of Alan Rickman, every year, you know, I someone always ends up, you know, watching Love Actually around me. And so, you know, this year, mm-hmm. every year, it's always like, oh no, Alan.
yeah.
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 But no, I agree. The cast is pretty solid across the board. And Henry, like you were saying, I think mm-hmm. I might enjoy the makeup and costume design in this one even more than I do in the first one. Like, I think
I do as well. Yeah.
You know, like Anne Hathaway, Johnny Depp, I mean, really everybody, like the makeup is mm-hmm. so good and it's so rich with like detail and variety. And so I love that part.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
So that part,
and I think especially Helena Bonham Carter's her like armor thing that's made out of like thorns. I really love
great
that
stuff.
I feel like we're missing a piece of the puzzle in like how she got this like giant thorn castle, like where that came mm-hmm. from. Because I thought she was in exile at the end of the first one. So
not well explained.
yeah, there's some jumps that I feel like would have been, you know, better to explore, but you know the designs were great. I mm-hmm. think.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not one of my favorites from old Disney. I wish I could love it more, but it's like, you know, I'll be with it for a little bit of time, but then once it gets into the heart, I really fall mm-hmm. off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It goes to they could lop off 20 minutes and this movie would still be fine.
Oh, easy. easy.
And yet somehow I also feel like the conclusion is really abrupt and like,
yeah.
you know, I would have liked some more time with maybe the red and white queen, you know, sort of like coming together. Cause you know, at the very end, the white queen is just like, I'm sorry. And the red queen's like, cool. That's all I wanted. And they're done. And I'm like, these two have been at it for like decades, hating each other. You know, this is a little quick, I think. So maybe, you know, and then maybe like a little bit longer of a scene with Johnny Depp reuniting with his family and like, you know,
yeah, cause that was
seeing
like
their relationship.
That was like a main motivator at the
yeah,
beginning.
Yeah. Like the main, you know, plot through line. And then it's like maybe under 2 minutes of him with his family, actually. There was just very little payoff, I think, in the end.
For sure. And one thing I will say, and it's the same thing with the first one that I do like, is that when she becomes miniature, I do like the kind of like problem solving, almost like video game sequences where she's like having to like get bigger for one moment and then like climb over a table. Like, I like that kind of playful, like video game esque player sequences, you know, where she's just having to like figure out how to get through a room or something, you know? Yeah, well, I mean, we have others to talk about, but I mean, anything else in particular about this one y'all want to bring up?
No, I think I'm good.
No,
covered it.
Yeah, I think we've hit it.
All right, well, out of 5 stars, everybody.
I'll give it 1.5 to 2.
Okay,
depending on my mood.
Henry?
Yeah, I was gonna say 2. I may lower it a bit, 1.5 probably. I'm tempted to say 2 just because I love the visuals so much, even if there's very little to like back them up. But
yeah, I'm a 2 as well, you know. What can you do? All right, well, let's get into the next film, one that was released just a couple months later, which is Pete's Dragon. And this one is directed by David Lowery, and it stars Bryce Dallas Howard, Robert Redford, Oakes Fegley, Una Lawrence, Wes Bentley, Carl Urban, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., and that's about it, I think. And the synopsis is the adventures of an orphan boy named Pete and his best friend Elliot, who happens to be a dragon. So this one made $143 million against a budget of $65 million. So again, not really a huge hit for Disney commercially, but it got much better reviews than Alice Through the Looking Glass, for sure. So, guys, how do you feel about this one?
Henry, do you want to take it away?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So this one, you know, is a remake of a much older film, and I'd never seen either one before watching it for this episode.
Oh, cool.
Well, so thank you for taking
the time.
Yeah, of course. I didn't have like an emotional attachment to the material because, you know, I hadn't been exposed to it growing up. And I really enjoyed this film overall. It's not perfect, but I think it's one of the better of the like Disney live action remake universe films. I think, you know, it sort of falls into the like live action Jungle Book sort of camp of, you know, kid orphan raised in wilderness. But, you know, I overall it was like the emotions were there, but I think the visuals really suffered. The CGI dragon was really what took me out of it. I would have loved for them to have done something more practical, you know, maybe. I'm hesitant to say like Jim Henson, because that may make it a little too like childlike, and right. I don't know if that's the vibe that they were going for, like a more emotional, dramatic film. But you know, it is what it is. I think the CGI is where it like sucked me out of the film, though, because I could definitely like there were moments where the dragon was on screen and I'm like, this is so fake, and they're clearly not interacting with a real dragon. It just I don't know. I didn't have that kind of response to it that I think they were desiring. Right. But Bryce Dallas Howard, she was great.
Yeah.
Love her in almost everything she does. And I think she really hit home the sort of like motherly instinct, you know, protective vibe. But yeah, I mean, it was a cute film. It was fine.
Yeah. Paul, now this was a first time watch for you, right?
Yeah, I hadn't seen this one either, and I hadn't seen the original Pete's Dragon. And I didn't go back and rewatch the old Pete's Dragon. I just jumped in with this one. And yeah, I liked it, you know. It's got some things that are a little bit sort of bland or for, you know, less memorable than maybe I would like or they would like, but for the most part, I think that it does its job well. You know, this is a magical friend story at its core, which is the second magical friend story that we've reviewed. The first one was Okja many years ago. And so.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Way back.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, it hits that arc very nicely. You know, it has that, it has all those sorts of beats, and you know, they put the sort of referential source material right there in front of you as well, of where some of this is getting pulled from. So I thought it did a good job. You know, again, I did some digging, and David Lowry, the director of this, has pretty much just done nothing but like small to mid budget stuff. And he's a writer, director, and sometimes even an editor. He edited his own film, A Ghost Story, with Casey Affleck and,
Rooney?
Yeah, Rooney Mara.
Hmm.
So, you know, I thought that he did fine here. I thought that this was a good little movie. Yeah, a little heavy on the narration at parts, but, you know.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Yeah, Paul, now that was, for Oakchair, that was back when we were recording in a movie theater, in an actual auditorium.
Yeah, you know?
Way back. Yeah, so I had seen this one. I, you know, after seeing A Ghost Story, I just had to say, okay, what's this guy all about? I have to see it. I guess this one, I got to it kind of late. I didn't see it in theaters. And it does, at least of the ones we're talking about, it feels the most like a regular movie. You know, it's not super dolled up. It's not super fancy. The story is very basic. And I think that kind of helps it and hurts it a little bit. I like how subdued it is. And he seems to like these subdued stories like that, and which I enjoy. And it's like, Paul, you were saying, it's not, there aren't a ton of memorable moments, but watching it in a vacuum, it's entertaining. It's, you know, charming and heartfelt at times. And I think the performances across the board are good. You know, Bryce Dallas Howard and Carl Urban is always fun. And Robert Redford as well, you know. So it's, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't have a whole lot to say about it other than it's kind of a fairly, Henry, as you said, like a cute, kind of harmless movie, you know. I can see why it didn't, you know, blow the doors off the box office, you know, but just for what it is, it's it's solid.
It's got this light little environmentalist message that, you know, if you read enough, it's there. The light capturing of Pete will definitely make like small children very upset, or of the dragon, not of Pete, but of Elliot the dragon.
Well, you never know.
You know, and so
maybe both.
You never know.
And you know, it also, I guess, it's sort of on top of, I guess, being a little bit fish out of, being a little bit magical friend. It's also a little fish out of water, a little bit almost like Tarzan, you know, getting to civilization for the first time. It hits, I think, all the beats that it needs to with the like wild boy story and the magical companion story. And it'll enter your life. It'll entertain you for a while and then it'll leave and you'll go, oh, that was fine. You know, you'll reflect back on it fondly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do like with along with his other films, it's only about 90 minutes. So kind of in and out, you know, that's kind of a nice change of pace for most Disney movies.
No, for
definitely.
Sure.
I put it on while I was crafting and just like, you know, had it on in the background. It was a nice sort of, you know, ambient noise film, I guess.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I guess since it's the only special effect of the movie, really, I don't dislike the look of the dragon, but I agree, Henry. I think something a little bit more practical would have been good, but I think that it is so like it just kind of blends into the background so well that I guess I just don't really think about it, but
yeah,
maybe try back in 10 years and who knows how it'll look, you know, you never
possibly
know.
Yeah. I think there was one shot where like the dragon was on top of a roof or something, and the shading was so incorrect. And like, I know shading. I had to study shading in college for my artwork, and it just like, it was not the way it should be from the light source. And like, that just really bugged me as a person who does, you know, like this sort of thing. If that's your one special effect that you're doing, you need to make sure that it's perfect across the board. Make sure that it's in the space, that it looks like it's present, that it's not just completely flat and washed out. Or do something, you know, I haven't seen the original film, but do something like that where it's a 2D animated character, completely unreal, you know, not live action, you know,
make that could be interesting.
Perfectly realistic or the complete other side of it and make it completely fake. Mm-hmm. You know, the middle ground, I think, is where they fail.
Yeah. Uncanny Valley stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do like the highway sequence, the bridge sequence where he's on the back of the trailer. I like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a cool shot. And at times you like comedic in a good way where he's just rolling down the highway with this dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, again, it's like for better or for worse, there's not a whole lot of specifics to say about it. It's just there.
None. Like, it's not even honestly terribly specific on like time period, you know, like is it? I don't know. I mean, I guess I could go and look.
Is it now? Is it the 70s? Who knows?
Yeah.
I guess I could go and look up when that Leonard Cohen song came out and I guess go like, you know, oh, I guess that's when it is. It's on the radio. Yeah. But, you know, who the hell knows?
Who has that time?
Yeah. No. I mean, I did like the soundtrack, though. You know, the choice of songs was very nice. Stuff that I listen to normally, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's worth a watch, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, if you got the time. Okay, well, anything else about Pete's Dragon?
No.
Yeah.
No, I'm good.
Oh, this is one of Robert Redford's last films before he retired.
Oh, is he officially retired?
I guess so, because actually, speaking of, the most recent film by David Lowery, The Old Man and the Gun, I think, is supposed to be his last film.
Okay.
But I'm not too sure, but yeah. And I guess he was in Captain America, right? The second one?
Yeah, Winter Soldier, but that was like 2014. That was like 2 years before this.
Yeah, that was
eight years ago. Yeah, that was a while ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Out of 5 stars for Pete's Dragon?
3.5, maybe 4.
Yeah,
you know,
3.5.
4 on a good day.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly, same place.
Cool, unanimous. Yep. Really speaks to the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Good job, Disney. You made a real workhorse.
You made
it a
real movie. Yeah.
Yes.
It sure exists.
Mm-hmm. all right, well, let's get into a big one. So let's get into Beauty and the Beast, the remake, which came out in 2017, one year later, and it's directed by Bill Condon, and it stars Emma Watson, Dan Stevens, Luke Evans, Josh Gad, Kevin Kline, Hattie Moran, Hayden Gwynn, Ewan McGregor, Ian McKellen, Emma Thompson, Audra McDonald, Stanley Tucci. Am I forgetting anybody big?
I think you got him. Did you say Mr. Kline?
Yes.
Kevin Kline.
Yeah, he's in there.
Okay.
And the synopsis is, a selfish prince is cursed to become a monster for the rest of his life unless he learns to fall in love with a beautiful young woman he keeps prisoner.
That's not a good description. She has to love him too.
No, that's not the best.
That's like the main point. There. She has to love him. Who writes these things?
That's what I'd like to know. All right. Well,
should be your job, Henry.
Yes, I know. I should email them.
Yeah, find whose job it is and steal it from them.
Yeah. Just go listen to Film Buds IMDb. You'll really want to have me there.
That's your interview.
Yeah. Well, this one was a big hit. It made $1.26 billion against a budget of around $200 million. And it, huge success commercially. And it got fairly good reviews, I think, across critics. And most audiences seem to be all right with it. Who wants to kick things off? This is a doozy.
Sure is.
I think the man with the Lumiere does need to begin.
No, that's true.
I think so.
Henry?
Yes. I also have a Cogsworth, but he's over on my table because he's so heavy.
Yes.
Okay, so I love Beauty and the Beast, the animated film, the original, so much. So when I heard that they were doing a live action, I was like very excited to see, you know, how they would interpret that story. Because I saw the Broadway musical when I was like 3 or 4, and it really inspired like my love of theater, my love of costume, my love of like stage adaptations of pre-existing source materials, like adaptation as its own thing. And those like three little bits are like really integral to who I am as a person. So I owe so much to Beauty and the Beast, and I really adore it. So I was very much intrigued by what they were going to do. And when I heard, you know, the list of the creative team, the cast, you know, everything, it sounded really great. I do think it's important to note that before this film was going to be made, I think it was Universal was going to do their own Beauty and the Beast live action that was going to be like a really dark, grim take on the story with Guillermo del Toro directing. And Emma Watson was going to be Belle, and it was going to be not musical. It was just going to be drama, dark drama. So I'm guessing sort of Crimson Peak-esque vibe.
Let's see that movie.
Oh, God. And so for some reason, as happens to so many of Mr. Del Toro's films, it, you know, fell through. It was canceled.
It's almost like becoming a joke at this point. Like,
it's a curse.
Know? Yeah.
But almost all of the concept artists and Emma Watson just transferred over to the Disney version when that happened, for better or worse. So, yeah, I think, you know, there are a lot of ideas that they made that are sure ideas, their choices. But I do not love the film as it exists as an end result. And I think it's that same sort of through the looking glass. You know, I like the individual, you know, aspects of the film, but the sum of the parts doesn't do it for me. I think I've seen it maybe three times. I saw it in the theater. I think I tried watching it once, and then I watched it for this. Because I remember walking out of the theater so disappointed and so like crestfallen and just like, you know, like empty. Because I had so much invested in this movie and they didn't live up to my expectations. And I can blame it on a few things. Emma Watson, first and foremost.
No way.
Yeah, who would have guessed? She's not a singer. They should not have cast her in this role. And, you know, I think even if they had just let her use her real voice instead of auto-tuning everything that comes out of her mouth, it may have been a little better. Because that's the whole point of the movie, that like our imperfections are what make us who we are. So she doesn't need to sound pristine and perfect, because that's not how she is. And, you know, Paige O'Hara, who played Belle in the animation, she doesn't have a perfect voice. I mean, she's a great singer, but it's not, you know, like completely auto-tuned, you know, and it's those individual little quirks that make your voice special. So I wish that they hadn't auto-tuned her voice. I wish that they had not digitally edited Dan Stevens' voice, who plays the Beast. It sounded so fake that it took me out of it every time he opened his mouth. And likewise, he's not a singer. And I think, you know, they should have just let him do his thing, or, you know, get someone else who is a, you know, classically trained singer. I think for the soundtrack release, there was an extra version of his song that was by Jonathan Groff or some Broadway performer. I don't remember who right now, but it was so much better. And I'm like, why didn't they have him play the Beast? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, there's so many of these like little instances where I'm like, you guys were so close to making the correct choice and then you didn't. Like, they cast Audra freaking McDonald as the wardrobe, like Broadway veteran, the most amazing, talented performer. And then they cast Emma Thompson as Mrs. Potts. I'm like, why don't you cast Audra McDonald as Mrs. Potts so that she can sing that title number instead of Emma Thompson doing her little fake Cockney accent thing?
Right.
So unnecessary. They cast Gugumbatha Raw as the Feather Duster. Why didn't you cast her as Belle? She can sing.
Oh, yeah.
She's a good dancer. She would wear a corset. Freaking Emma Watson. I'm still bitter that she wouldn't wear a corset.
Oh wait, no, I don't know about this, or maybe I missed it.
Maybe.
So what happened? What did Emma do?
So here's what Emma do, and why I'm still mad about it 3-4 years later. So when they originally designed Belle's costumes, they were like period accurate, like the rest of the film. You know, the costume design is pretty fantastical, but very rooted in historical fashion.
Yeah.
And that's how they originally designed Belle. She would have worn, you know, what we call corset, but back then they were called stays. And it really, it's not a torture device. It doesn't, you know, cut off your circulation. It just creates a shape so that you can wear the proper silhouette gowns. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't cut off your, you know, blood flow or anything. It's like a sports bra, basically. And that's how they originally designed the costumes. And then Emma Watson comes in and she says, with her BuzzFeed, you know, knowledge, corsets are bad. Corsets are harmful. I've seen Pirates of the Caribbean. I can't breathe with a corset on. And so they threw out all the original designs. She didn't have a corset on, so all of her costumes were wrinkly. And then she also refused to wear, you know, a chemise. She refused to wear panniers. So her ball gown is this limp, lifeless Party City prom dress looking thing. When originally it would have been, and I am mad about this. I mean, like, literally all the other ball gowns in the film, like in the prologue with all of those ladies in the white dresses.
Yeah.
That's what we could have had for Belle, except gold.
See, Henry, she loves to be on a staircase in a dress. You know, she wants to go back
she
to that Goblet of
Harry
Fire
Potter.
Territory. You know, she has even to have it.
She has to, but even the Goblet of Fire dress, I believe I read online, it had boning inside. So it had like a little secret corset built in. So maybe Emma didn't know about that, or maybe she didn't hate them at that point, but
secrets out, you know, Emma.
And then secrets out. But yeah, I am never going to live it down. If I ever meet her in person, it's going to be on site.
Make sure to be recording that.
Oh my God. It'll go viral.
Yeah, we'll play
I'll
it
probably
here.
Probably get thrown in jail, but you know, it just, it, you know, and like so many of the other decisions in the film, they were close to making something that was really artistically poignant, and instead they decided to cater to the BuzzFeed articles, the YouTube analytic videos, the, you know, mindless critiques that are unnecessary of kowtowing to. And so I wish that they had done something a little more adventurous. Yeah, that's, I could go on and on and on and on for hours. So I need to cut it, but
yeah, out of five stars.
Oh God.
Okay. All right, Paul, you want to go?
Yeah, sure.
I have to give it a rating that's a Chloe rating, because only a Chloe rating will do it.
Please.
It's like you go to a really fancy restaurant and you get these amazing, like, frites, you know, fries.
Yes.
And they're incredible. They have like the perfect amount of seasoning. So good.
Yes.
But you can't finish them. And so you have to take it home and you put them in the fridge and you forget about it for a couple days. And then you're like, oh, I should eat those before they go bad. So you put them in the microwave and then they come out and they're like limp and soggy, and then the inside is somehow still cold, but then the outside is burning hot.
It's got ketchup in there soaking up.
Somehow the ketchup is there, even though I don't remember using ketchup.
Exactly.
And it's just not a good experience.
Okay.
So that's my rating.
That's very fitting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Paul?
Sure. So first off, you know, I couldn't agree with you more on being profoundly disappointed by this movie. So this was one of the last movies that I ended up seeing, I think, when I was in LA, and I went and I saw it at Grauman's Chinese Theater in 3D, did the whole thing, like really, really went all out for this one. And, and I was so bitterly angry leaving that movie, and my, girlfriend at the time just fucking loved it. Like, this was her crack. Like,
did you break up over that?
We almost did that night, and I'm not even fucking around. Like, we ended up in a fight. Like, we were arguing about this movie. I was so glad that we took two cars, like, to meet there. Because she met me there, like, after work. And so then in the ride home, I was like, that fucking movie. Can't believe that she likes this movie.
Yeah.
So, no, it's just, It's such a shame. It's such a wasted opportunity. I love the original. It's one of my favorites from the Renaissance. It's so enjoyable, and this is just so not that. And like the ballroom scene feels so puny comparatively, just tiny. Yeah. And the whole thing.
And the original, the animation felt so big.
Yeah, grand.
And like sweeping. Yeah. Incredible. And
it's just
how
lame. It's just a lame duck thing. And Be Our Guest is just such a visual feast. And here it's so like muted. And then that's the thing. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, the sort of Harry Potterization of the thing. You know, when you get to the later Harry Potter films, everything gets a little bit more muted and a little bit less magical and a little bit more sad. And that's how I feel kind of about Beauty and the Beast, for sure.
Yeah. Well, this was the first time watch for me.
Oh, Henry.
Yeah, I think I had tried to watch it about a year ago, and I just only watched maybe 10 or 15 minutes. So this was, and by the end, I mean, I think I'm around the same place y'all are. I don't hate the movie. I think it's kind of right down the middle. Like it's okay. I'm not like I do like the animated Beauty and the Beast, but I'm not like someone who like grew up with that movie, so I don't have as much of the personal connection to it. My favorite is actually the 40s one, the French one. I love that one.
Okay. Jean Cocteau.
Yeah. And so kind of I went into it fairly like the others were talking about, and I agree totally. I think the Be Our Guest sequence is great. And I think the rest of the movie, there are great visuals. And I think that Bill Condon, he seems to really care about the Belle and Beast relationship. But I feel like every time he cuts away to Luke Evans and the dad, it's like the life is just sucked out of it. I feel like they almost go back to that out of obligation to have like a conflict there. And I feel like I so badly want to be in that castle for most of the time. And whether it's due to performances or what, or the storytelling, it's very inconsistent for me. And also the pacing is brutal. This movie goes on, feels like it goes on forever. Like that third act is so extended. And it's like what, 2 hours and 20 minutes?
Yeah.
This is like a Marvel, like Civil War, like Captain America Civil War. Like
it's a that, doozy. Like,
yeah. And so, no, go ahead, Paul.
Go for it.
Okay. I don't know if I would say I dislike it. Will I ever watch it again? Probably not. Emma Watson, I agree. Her singing, I didn't like loathe. It was more so her like performance moments. Like there are times where she's like in her bedroom locked away, and it's like it cuts to her being scared, and it just did not come through for me. You know,
she doesn't have a lot of presence.
No. And there are things I like her in. You know, it's not like I think she's bad across the board, but in this I think she was miscast.
Very
for sure.
Yeah.
My wife all the time is like, you know, there are so many talented, beautiful looking people that can definitely pull off the part of Belle. We didn't need to go for Emma Watson. And it's actually interesting. She left La La Land to come to this. So like she was just also kind of hellbent on a musical at a certain point. Like this was going to bleed into the schedule for Beauty and the Beast was going to bleed into La La Land. And she was like this over that. And that's
thank goodness for that.
I mean, I guess. And so then our director, Bill Condon, the reason he might be good with the whole, you know, Stockholm Syndrome, story, is that he is our director for Breaking Dawn Part 1 and Part 2.
Yes.
And then our writers, just for a little reference point for
This is weird. Yeah. Yeah. I know
For my least favorite, I guess, aspect of the writing elements is that one of your writers is a guy named Evan.
Go for it.
Spiliotopoulos, I think is how we're going to go for that. And he brought us Cinderella 3, A Twist in Time. So we've got ourselves like an old Disney machine writer. And I think that this whole culmination is why we end up with just like a half-baked thing. We've got like the director of Twilight films who can kind of do one thing. We've got this Disney writer who's been with us for a while and he knows the brand. He knows what he's doing. And then we got the guy who wrote the Rent movie. and, you know, let's just bring him on board. And
wait, and now didn't that guy do Perks of Being a Wallflower?
Yes, he did. Yeah, okay. That was our writer. Yeah. Steve Chobsky is his name. Yeah. And he's also, fun fact, going to be, according to the internet, according to IMDb, our director for the Evan Hansen adaptation.
Okay.
So for all of our listeners who know Broadway, there you go.
The Dear Evan Hansen movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Directed by the writer of Beauty and the Beast and Perks of Being a Wallflower. Coming at you live.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
It does. Yeah, it does feel half baked, and the kind of classical story is there, but yeah, it's like it's on like autopilot, you know?
Yeah. And well, it's like we have to hit the classic story beats, but then they've also shoehorned in all of these other little, you know, plot devices that go nowhere. Like the bell is an inventor thing that's brought up once or twice and then never used for the rest of the film. And then this like magical tapestry book thing that takes them to, you know, time travel, and then it's the never used or brought up ever again. Your father's in danger. Why don't you use this magical port key to go save him instead of, you know, galloping away on your horse? I don't get it.
Yeah. And now also, Paul, you were talking about Bill Condon. He is also director of The Fifth Estate, the WikiLeaks Julian Assange biopic.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got an interesting filmography there.
Yeah. And he's also done stage work as well. He directed Sideshow the Musical, which my friend Susan was actually in, which was, pretty cool. So like, I feel like he tried his darndest to give us something, you know, good. And actually, I know his partner, who I spoke with on several occasions when the movie was in development.
Oh, cool.
And like, I think for the most part, he really tried to do something that was, you know, a standalone film. And I think it really was like the Disney management interference, you know, that may have dragged it down.
Oh, yeah.
That's what my takeaway, maybe like the corporate side of things. They were like, we have to hit these story beats from the animation. We can't do anything different. We have to have, you know, some new songs that serve no point so that we can get that, like, you know, Oscar nom. We have to have, you know, the merchandising aspects. So it's like all of those interferences are what made it so terrible, I think.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And now I do like the look, even though it is like really all CG. I do like the look of the Beast. I think like the costumes and the hair, I think that looks good.
And that's a holdover from the Del Toro film, actually.
That makes sense.
The look of the Beast. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the castle with like the ice and everything.
Yeah.
No, a lot of the thing that does like, you know, work about this film are the visuals, and it totally makes sense that those all came from a Del Toro film.
Kind of like the Hobbit films.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, I didn't, there are parts of it I enjoyed and I was, you know, entertained by, but man, it really wears out its welcome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Very.
Disappointing.
Yeah. And I don't love Josh Gad. He's all right in this, but I don't love him.
Hit or miss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hit or miss.
I've never seen him live on stage. I think he may be a better stage actor, but I'm not a fan. I wish they would stop casting him in movies because I just don't enjoy him at all.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it, Henry.
There you go. And actually, when I saw Frozen on Broadway, the actor who played Olaf was Greg Hildreth, who I actually think is way more hilarious than Josh Gad. Greg has played a lot of Josh's theatrical roles, you know, sort of following in the footsteps. And I think he's way more hilarious. He has way better comedic timing, more of a presence, and just like less grating, you know. He doesn't like make my head hurt like Josh Gad does.
Yes. All right, well, out of 5 stars for Beauty and the Beast,
1.
Ooh,
hard one.
harsh.
0.5.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I'll go
the best.
I'll go 2.5. It's, you know, I wasn't beating myself. I enjoyed it more than Alice Through the Looking Glass, I'll say that.
Yeah.
Oh. So, lesser of two evils.
I don't know. That's just root canals on different teeth. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. All right. Well, so two left here. Let's get into what's next here. What's next? There's got to be. Okay. So next one is Christopher Robin, which came out in 2018, and it's directed by Mark Forster. It stars Ewan McGregor, Haley Atwell, Bronte Carmichael, Mark Gatiss, Agent Carter. What's her name? Oh, hey, that's Haley Atwell. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oliver Ford Davies. Am I forgetting any big names here?
Mm-mm.
No.
I think you got it.
All right. And the synopsis is, a working class family man, Christopher Robin, encounters his childhood friend, Winnie the Pooh, who helps him rediscover the joys of life. So this one made $197 million against a budget of $75. So not a huge hit for Disney, but it was fairly well received. Guys, what do you think of Christopher Robin?
You know, honestly, I don't hate it. It's
we're loving these movies.
You know, yeah. I think that even if I don't love it, here's, I guess, what I'll say about Christopher Robin is, like, I like it well enough. It's cute. It's an interesting take on, like, the look of the characters, which I think is exciting.
Yeah.
And I think that it's got some good performances in it. And I think that even though it's never going to be one that I, like, let's fucking watch Christopher Robin, I think that ultimately it's going to be some other, like, generation's Hook. You know, like, I think that if you're of the younger generation and you try to watch Hook, you're like, what in the fuck is this?
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, it's going to come out and hit a generation in such a way that, like, this is the same equivalent kind of story. You know, sad, washed up old character that we know and love gets his childhood reignited by all of his old pals. So I think that it'll probably end up doing fine. But I, you know, it's kind of, I guess, for me, a little bit like Pete's Dragon. Like, it's charming.
Yeah. Henry?
Honestly, I agree 100%. I hadn't thought of it as, like, you know, this kid's generation Hook, you know, like, that's weird to think about, that movies coming out right now will, like, become cult classics someday.
That is weird.
I hope that doesn't happen for Beauty and the Beast. Don't you guys dare make this happen. But I will come after every one of those cult followers. But I think this was a really charming film. I think my mom responded to it more than I did.
Mine did as well.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was fine. I enjoyed it, but it definitely, like, it hit the sad theme really well, I think. And I felt that, like, emotional, like, poignancy that they were going for. And I really did like the look of the, you know, the stuffed animal, but also, like, real creature, you know, CGI characters. I thought those were really fun. And yeah, overall, I mean, I liked it. It's not a movie that I'm going to, like, watch all the time, you know, that I absolutely love. But, like, you know, it's also not one that I'm going to, like, vehemently despise, like a certain other one that we've reviewed. I think it was pretty well done overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I hate to say it, I'm on the exact same page as y'all.
Yeah, there
surprise.
It is.
Yeah.
Unanimity.
I mean, this one, I think, of the ones we're talking about, works the best emotionally for me. I think there were some really well-done, heartfelt moments, especially with Ewan McGregor and Winnie. I think those scenes work really well. And Mark Forster, he just kind of makes, like, he's a little bit like Ron Howard, like, he kind of makes middle of the road, like, kind of like he did Quantum of Solace, World War Z, you know, films that have their moments, but none that I really love.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is similar to that, maybe towards the top, though. But no, it's charming, as we've said, you know, heartfelt. I do like Ewan McGregor a lot. I mean, it's kind of hard to go wrong with him. And
yeah,
the voice cast for the toys are also great.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
Hayley Atwell is always solid. Really mm-hmm. enjoy her.
Underutilized. Yeah.
Yes, for sure.
So, you know,
very.
At least this is another film that utilizes a very much underutilized British talent.
Yes.
Because contrary to popular belief, there are more British actors than just the 10 that are
yeah.
no. cast and everything. No, no, is this like, I don't unpopular think
so.
Opinion?
It's Benedict Cumberbatch, it's Tom Hiddleston.
I've only seen those three.
Oh, gosh.
And Keira Knightley, and that's
yes.
it. That's
oh, we can't forget Keira.
Uh-huh.
Can't forget yeah. her.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, actually, Henry, no, I really did like, I did like the voices for the animated, you know, Winnie the Pooh characters, because I think for the most part they were like the animated voices from, like, you know, the cartoons, not, you know, the very, very, very first one that Disney ever did, but like the ones that came out, I think, in the 90s or more recently that Disney has used.
I think it's definitely Jim Cummings, and then I think it's like Brad Garrett yeah. who fills in for Eeyore, but like Brad Garrett is an Eeyore. That's his type. So it
yeah.
works great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It worked very well, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, I think the kind of like the sadness and loneliness of not only Ewan McGregor, but I think Winnie the Pooh as well, that kind of like disappointed is really effective for me. And I do find like with movies like this, and it's kind of a recurring thing with these movies, they just have to make it like visually dark. Like it's mm-hmm. so like cloudy and like.
That's just how it looks in England, Henry.
Oh, yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. But like there are times where like they're in the woods and it becomes a little too monotonous, you mm-hmm. know, like I completely agree. That's how England is. And I love it. But
yeah.
I think at times visually it became a little repetitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I sometimes agree completely. And sometimes I wonder if this is like a digital problem, because I don't remember it as much with like older films shot on film. You know, I think maybe that like grit might help a bit.
It's a color grading issue. It's people going in and you know, fiddling around. So, cause you know, I've got the digital tools to go and pick my color palette perfectly. Yeah. You know?
Exactly. It's like here, because I can, I'm gonna.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes like,
it doesn't need it.
Should I make Christopher Robin look like a horror film?
Should I make this look like King's Speech? Is that
like
the look
Sleepy Hollow? Yeah. You know,
is that what people want?
Yeah,
yeah.
But no, it's I enjoy it. And this was a first time watch for me. I hadn't seen it before we decided to do this.
Okay.
Not that that has any relevance.
Nah,
it's just,
you know,
a fact.
No. Just stating things. I had seen it like in bits and pieces, and then like more recently I finally saw it in a single sitting for the first time. But no, it's great, you know. The Winnie the Pooh is the Buddha, you know, he just kind of accepts life and keeps going, and I think that they nailed that for Winnie the Pooh. He never seems like an idiot, you know, he never seems like a lummox, you know. He just has the right amount of just sort of like, I'm being, that I think makes Winnie the Pooh charming as a character and timeless.
Yeah. Yeah. And I never really, really, like, personally, I never tire of the, like, human character interacting with a creature of some kind, trying to hide them from regular society. I just enjoy that kind of comedic opportunity, you know, and like they're on the like the street, and there's like, I guess it's like a telephone call or something, and they're just all those like sleight of hands is really enjoyable. And yeah, it's a cool little like under the radar film, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you could definitely watch worse. We have watched worse.
For sure. Yeah, only recently.
This is true.
All right, well, anything else about Christopher Robin?
It was a charming little film.
Yes.
It's cute.
If you like Doctor Who, the shithead bad guy is one of the writers of Doctor Who and the BBC Sherlock, so...
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, always in there for the fun facts.
Yeah, that's what I'm here for. It's what I live for.
Cool.
All right, well, out of five, guys...
I'll go 4, honestly. You
Yeah. I was going to say like 4, 4.5, if I'm being kind.
Yeah. And please, Henry, be kind, you know? I'll go 4 as well.
Yeah.
4.5 on a good day. All right. Well, let's get on to the absolute best of the bunch, the Nutcracker and the Four Realms, which came out the same year. I think just a couple months later.
It was such a weird release time.
It was
like because it was Christopher Robin and Nutcracker and also like Mary Poppins with Emily Blunt and like so much happening.
Packed year,
you know.
So this one is directed by Joe Johnston and Lassie Hallstrom, I think is how you say it. And it stars Mackenzie Foy, Keira Knightley, Tom Sweet, Mira Sile, Morgan Freeman. Who's the father?
Matthew McFadden.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Richard E. Grant, Jack Whitehall. Am I forgetting anybody big?
Did you say Helen Mirren?
Oh yeah, there she is. Yes, thank you.
She's in there too.
Yes, she is. Thank you. All right, and then the synopsis is a young is transported into a magical world of gingerbread soldiers and an army of mice. Not the best.
No.
And the it made $174 million against a budget of around $130 million, so not a hit for sure commercially. I think the reviews were fairly mixed, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and Henry, as you were saying, this one kind of came at a weird time, and I feel like it was gone in no time. You know,
So
many people were
Chloe
like...
Chloe and I...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, a lot of people were bamboozled, and Chloe and I were going to try to go see it, and it was gone so quick that we missed it. And I think also they released it in, like, beginning of November or, like, late October, and it's... I would say it's like a Christmas movie, because it takes place on Christmas Eve. You know, so why wouldn't you release this in December? They released Mary Poppins in December, and I feel like that release schedule just didn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think if they had released this around Christmas, it may have done a little bit better. You know, if this had been the Christmas movie for people to go see, because I think a lot of people waited. They were like, oh, well, I'm not going to go see that. I'm going to go see Mary Poppins, you know, next month or whatever. So I think it flew under a lot of people's radars. Which was, you know, a disservice on Disney's part, I think, because out of the five that we're talking about today, I think this one is the best.
Henry, can I tell you, I'm on the same page. I was worried that was going to be a hot take, but
no,
it's good. Not at all.
I've seen this movie so many times. As you can see, I love my Sugar Plum Fairy. I'm going to make this costume someday.
Oh yeah.
Like I love this film and I'm not afraid to say it, you know?
Yeah. Paul, this had to be a first time watch.
It was, so it's a first time watch, and there's actually only one writer in specific for this film. It's Ashley Powell. The reason that there are multiple listed writers is because it's source material, and so there are three versions of the Nutcracker story. There is the ballet, there is the Alexandre Dumas story that the ballet is based on, and then there is the original work that Dumas was basing his on, which was written by a guy named E.T.A. Hoffman. And this is an adaptation of the Hoffman story and the ballet combined, which is an interesting way to go. And so even though there are some things about this movie, like narratively, that I think are a little bit sticky, if you will. Ultimately, I like very much preferred this over like Allison Through the Looking Glass. You know, I was more engaged with this. I very much enjoy the visuals of this film a lot. It's a very, very pretty film. I was a little bit bored by Anne Hathaway in Alice, but then, you know, I kind of had the inverse problem with Kira, where I was getting a lot of personality. Very sexually charged.
I wish Kira had more time.
So the thing
with the
and
tin soldiers, just like, hello, boy.
Yes.
Oh, I love her.
That thing. So when I saw this for the first time, I talked about it on the regular show a while back.
Yeah.
I could not believe Keira Knightley's performance and that writing was in a Disney film. It's so like it's so hypersexualized and so like
there.
It's so there and so wild.
In your face.
I was like, I could not believe this was like a Disney film, but in a cool way. I mean, at least for me, I think that was
She's
so. Again, she's so there. Bonkers. And it's so cool.
Yeah.
I think the reason
I love that they cast Keira for this role.
Yeah.
Like it's so left field from other stuff that she's done, and I think she nails it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think the reason that this movie kind of gets away with being a little bit weirder is because Lassie Hallström is like a European director, and his filmography is stuff like Chocolat and what's another one of his? Oh God, I looked him up earlier.
Come on, Paul.
It's coming. 100-Foot Journey, I think, with Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
And so he does What's Eating Gilbert Grape is another one, which I think kind of treads into like magical fantasy almost in certain elements of that story. And so I think that he does some really interesting like character choices that are more reminiscent of like older Disney, I think, choices than a lot of what you get now. And so out of all the like sort of adaptation stuff that we get, I think that at least this one was really going out on a limb and like trying something and swinging hard for something, whether or not it lands for you is a personal choice. But, I definitely preferred this over a lot of other stuff that I've seen recently.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the same. I didn't see it in theaters, and I only got to it, I don't know, maybe a year later. And as you were saying, Paul, it's like it's very ambitious. It goes for it. And I agree. I don't think every, step hits, but it's so strange and weird. Like the visuals are great. It looks amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, the costume design is fantastic as well.
Mm-hmm.
And like the whole the Helen Mirren circus thing. Crazy.
Oh, the weird stacking doll clowns were great and awful in all of the right ways. Yes,
at the same time.
Yeah. I think the main actress, she was in, not Dunkirk,
Interstellar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like her. And I mean, the whole cast is pretty solid, but Keira Knightley, amazing. And it's just, no, go ahead, Paul.
She was also in Breaking Dawn Part 2 with Bill
Condon.
She was
Renesmee.
our little child.
Yeah.
Little vamp baby.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's so, you kind of just have to see it to believe it, you know? Again, it's kind of baffling that this is a Disney film, you know?
Yeah. I went and I looked at the old Nutcracker story and in the E.T.A. Holmes version, he was writing around the same time as Amadeus Mozart and German Gothic and German Romanticism. And so his story was very, very much weirder. And it wasn't until Dumas came along and kind of brightened it up that it got more sort of sugar plum fairies. But the Mouse King of the original story is seven headed. And there's all of this murder and betrayal and it's good stuff. So, and I think that that's also why they're able to do some really cool stuff. I loved the sort of, weird golem of mice.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the ballerinas and the mice costumes. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Yeah. The whole ballet sequence and also the dance
Copeland
during the end credits. Yeah. Misty was amazing. Mm-hmm. And they had my least favorite male ballet dancer of all time, Sergei Polonin, dancing with her. I despise him, but whatever. That's neither here nor there.
Sure.
I just have to say because I don't like him. So, Misty, she was great.
Yeah. Even though I don't dance myself, I love ballet and watching ballet and seeing the behind the scenes. I love all that stuff. And so, that part is a great, aspect of the film for me. And it is also the Joe Johnston who did, Captain America, the First Avenger, the Wolfman remake. Great film. Jumanji, the original. Mm-hmm. So he's done some
Hidalgo,
interesting
the Rocketeer.
Yes. So he's done some interesting films.
Jurassic Park 3.
Yes.
And he started in the special he was brought in to do the reshoots for special effects scenes that Lassie Hallström couldn't shoot. And it's because Joe Johnston actually started back in visual effects and second unit directing. And so he was doing visual effects on like Return of the Jedi and some stuff like that.
Oh, cool.
And he was supposed to be the director of the second Jurassic Park film. But at the last minute, Spielberg was like, I'm going to do it. And then we're going to do a third, and I promise you, you can do the third one. And he was like, okay.
Classic Steven.
Right.
And so he was brought in specifically to do like visual effects heavy reshoots. And he had to like get cleared, because apparently there's like a Directors Guild rule that unless you're a team, you can't have two directors on a title card, which is why Bryan Singer is the one that's listed on Bohemian Rhapsody and not the guy that they brought in after they fired him, Dexter Fletcher. And so Lassie Hallström had to be like, no, he can be on there.
Well, interesting.
And yeah, I think it's one of those movies, I think since it didn't do all that well, it kind of has a bad reputation, you know, and but I feel like it is really worth a watch. And also, since it is fairly plotless, I think that's another reason why some people find it easy to like pick apart and hate on. But really, I mean, that's what I enjoy, like with this kind of film, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's what's strong about this one and what's weak about Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Exactly. Yeah,
is like, if you're going to have a weak plot, it needs to be weak for a reason. You know, like if you think about this film, it's more of like a classic fairy tale rather than, you know, a more modern version of what we would consider a fairy tale. And I think that's what works for it best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to think if there's anything else. Just I mean, there are just so many weird moments that I love.
Yeah,
and, you know,
I do want to say though, for this, almost all of the sets were practical rather than being in a green screen, and it feels that way. You know, the characters are way more present. Whereas, you know, in the Alice films, it definitely has that like this is a CGI constructed, you know, dreamscape. But you know, the world of the Nutcracker. I remember reading an interview. Where I think it was like a cut scene when they're in this like, you know, candy village and the stuff is made of real candy. And they were like, you know, it smelled so good. And like, you know, with the, I think there's a scene where they're like driving through like an ice village.
And
that was all made of like,
great stuff.
Plexiglass and like, you know, translucent materials. And like, instead of being CGI, I think that was so ambitious and I want to see more of it. I wish that people would do this more, you know, the, you know, tangible, real sets. If you're going to go CGI with effects, that's fine, but have some of both, I think. And that's one of the strongest points of the film, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I feel like I want to have more to say about it because I enjoy it, you know, but like, it's just a really cool movie.
I think this will be one that, especially because it exists on Disney Plus, will probably end up getting a little bit more of a cult following over time just because it is a little bit weirder. And I think that there will probably be kids that, you know, end up just coming across it when they're young on Disney Plus and are like, oh, you know, I love this. And they aren't going to get the innuendo and all of that stuff. By the way,
no.
I would like to say that the innuendo did not get this movie a PG. It got a PG for a direct note, some mild peril.
Not Keira Knightley.
No.
PG. Keira Knightley is horny.
Yeah, basically.
PG for a horned up sugar plum.
I would just love to have seen like when they like Keira got on set for the first time and people were just like, all right, Keira, go do your thing, and just them seeing her
a bit of
I read somewhere that like the accent was entirely her idea, that she wanted to do this like really outlandish, you know, princessy voice. And I love that she did that because it's so like, you know, 11 out of 10, it's 11. It's so much.
And that could have so easily been horrible. Like that kind of performance. It could have been terrible.
It's the right kind of camp that's like so cheesy that you can't help but love it, you know.
And I love, there's one scene where I think the girl gets to the kingdom and she meets meets Bubblegum, and I think it's Richard E. Grant who has this like incredible costume, and that set, that kind of circular is amazing. I love that.
Yeah. definitely.
So Richard E. Grant walks in looking like Mr. White Christmas from Rankin Bass.
Yeah.
And
then there's the guy with like the flower beard and like very much me. Love that.
Yeah. And he starts talking and I think to myself and I'm like, wait a minute. Is that the Mad Hatter's dad? Did they get re-siphons in this? And then I was like, no, wait, it's Richard E. Grant. They're just the same. They're just the same type.
Yes.
Yeah. Basically the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pick up, put there, same effect.
Yeah, well, I mean, guys, I mean, any anything else about the Nutcracker and the Four Realms?
You know, actually, yes, before we wrap it up. So with this, they sort of did the same sort of, you know, engineer girl thing that they wanted to do with Belle in Beauty and the Beast, but then it went nowhere. In this, the engineering thing actually comes up multiple times throughout the story and actually helps them during the climax and the conclusion. You know, it's like, this is actually how, you know, you make a plot device and integrate it in your story.
Crazy.
And have it serve a purpose.
Who would have
thought? Who would have thought that it works? So I just have to say, it was nice to see, like, girl as inventor when that was not the thing, done right, because it's a cool plot device. And I think, you know, they let it fall flat in Beauty and the Beast. And this time it actually did a good job serving the plot. And, you know, I'm very happy about that.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Paul, anything else for you, man?
No. Fun fact, E.T.A. Hoffman used to be E.T.W. Hoffman. He was Wilhelm, but he loved Mozart so much that he went and changed his other middle name to Amadeus.
Hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Paul, I'm so glad you shared that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. That is super cool.
That's cool.
I also love that they named the Nutcracker Hoffman as like a reference to him.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a nice touch. Yeah, like all of the nods to the ballet and to the original written story. And, you know, even with the ballet performance in the movie, the beginning was sort of like a reference to Disney's Fantasia, you know, with the orchestra and the light.
Yeah.
You know, all of the little meta references. There was a sequence when they're in the hot air balloon where there's like the spiral yellow brick road from the Wizard of Oz. You know, there's so many different nods to like the whole genre and all of these, you know, different stories that have come before that I really appreciated as well. I think they, you know, did a nice job with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, out of 5 stars for Nutcracker.
It's a 5. I love this one.
I think I'm like a heavy 4. Heavy 4 for me.
I'll go 3.5.
All right. Not too bad.
Cool.
Well, I mean, anything else kind of wrapping up here? Anything else to say about Disney? Any, you know, anything coming up? Any leaving thoughts?
Oh, Henry, you know, Little Mermaid, I am like so apprehensive.
Yeah.
So now, I have so much, you know, on the line for this one.
Yeah, now that's who's doing that? Who's directing it? The guy who did Into the Woods, is it?
Yeah, Rob Marshall.
Yeah.
He also did, you know, Chicago, Memoirs of a Geisha. He was the choreographer for Cinderella with Brandy and Whitney Houston.
Oh.
That Disney did in the 90s. So he's been like all over the place film wise.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that one,
Colleen Atwood's coming back for costumes because she works with him in almost everything. And I think, I don't remember who the writer is. Jane Goodman?
Oh, yeah. She did, was it Peregrine's Home? Miss Peregrine's Home?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Jenny, I her name is like escaping me, but yeah, I think you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But I think they cast Halle Bailey as Ariel, you know, of course. You know, the young African American singer, of course, in the animated movie, Ariel is white. So I think already with that choice, they're making really unexpected choices.
Yeah.
And I really hope that that makes this film stronger than, say, Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast were, because it already is seeming like they're not going to be so devoted to the animation that it is to the detriment of the live action adaptation. I think they're going to try to go in a more creative direction. At least that's what I've been hearing.
Yeah.
So Henry, fingers crossed. Yeah.
You didn't like Guy Ritchie's Aladdin?
How could I not? Henry, you remember, I think wasn't that my first episode or maybe not?
Oh, but actually may have been. Yeah. Actually, yeah.
I think it was. Yeah. I'm not sure. But, I mean, it was fine. It was, you know.
Paul, anything for you, man? Any leaving thoughts about anything
in the world? Sure. You know, adaptation, reimagining, reinvention have been a part of art and artistic expression forever. You know, plays and theater has just for years, you know, been a lot of people redoing a lot of classics. You know, I mean, Shakespeare's been done 1,000 ways. Countless painters have done The Last Supper. So, you know, reimagining and adaptation and reinventing isn't the problem. The problem is doing it without anything new to say or anything new to explore in the material. Yeah. And so if you have nothing new to say, you know, don't say it at all. You know, it's kind of like if you have nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. If you have nothing new to say, just stay at home.
What's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, have you guys, Henry, I think we've talked about it before. Have you seen the Beauty and the Beast, the French one from like 5-6 years ago with Léa Seydoux? I think it is.
Yes. Yeah. It was on Netflix for the longest time. I don't know if it is anymore.
Yeah.
I loved that version way more than the live action Disney film, except for the little CGI like dog, you know, creatures, whatever those were, nonsense. But the rest of the film was great. Paul, take those little creatures out of it and it's fine.
Yeah. Paul, did you see that one?
No, I'll have to give it a look.
Yeah, it's interesting for sure.
Very much. It's more closely related to like the original written story.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting to see it brought to life in that way.
Now, has anyone here seen the old Ron Perlman TV show that was written by George R.R. Martin long before he wrote Game of Thrones?
No.
Yeah, there's an old Beauty and the Beast TV show.
Is this the one from the 80s or the 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I have.
Yeah, you have to look that one up, Henry.
Okay.
It's something. Be prepared for the like prosthetic face.
But just know underneath that it's Ron Perlman face. So then ask yourself, what would you rather be looking at?
Yeah.
True.
Yes, good point.
I love you, Ron Perlman. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Now I'm imagining like Beauty and the Beast, except it's Hellboy. Ron Perlman as Hellboy. Nothing else has changed, just that.
That's the next reimagining
of that's Hellboy 3.
Okay.
The next there Hellboy.
When they bring back Guillermo and, you know, we continue on and act like the David Harbour one never happened.
Yeah.
That one never happened. Oh god.
Well, I mean, I guess that is about it. And I mean, everybody, thank you for taking the time to download it. And again, it just goes to help support the keep the show going, and you know, we appreciate the donations for sure. And make sure to check out the other bonus shows as well. Yeah, well, guys, I mean, it's great to see both of you. Thank you so much for taking the time to not only be here, but to watch the movies. I'm sure it was a wonderful time for you.
It was. It actually was.
Good.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, better than the movies was, you know, being here to chat with you guys.
So. Exactly. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, great to, you know, hear from like-minded people and people who are also approaching it from a different perspective and a different appreciation of different aspects of the art.
Yeah,
definitely.
Sure. All right, everybody. Well, we hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and we'll see you next time.